Hello, and welcome to the EG Property Podcast, with me, Tim Burke, EG's Deputy Editor. This episode was recorded as part of our Future of UK Cities event, a series of interviews and panels in which we explored the challenges and the opportunities ahead for cities across the country. This panel, which was supported by DAC Beechcroft, Black Professionals in Construction, and Glasgow City Council, explored social integration and the role that cities play in creating an equal society. How can planning help to design out exclusion? How can physical and digital infrastructure encourage integration? And ultimately, how can development bring people together from all walks of life? My guests on the panel were Emma Carriaga, Joint Head of the Canada Water Development at British Land, Angus Miller, a councillor at Glasgow City Council, Amos Simbo, the founder of the Black Professionals in Construction Network, and Christopher Stanwell, partner and head of planning at the law firm DAC Beechcroft. Enjoy the conversation. Christopher, I'm going to pick on you to kick us off, if that's okay. Now, I suppose you can argue that social inclusion sometimes can be something of a happy byproduct of the places that, real estate creates. Do you believe that the industry focuses often enough on social inclusion as a goal in and of itself, a desired direct outcome of the places that it makes and creates?
The short answer to that, in my experience, is no. That said, there are schemes and projects where I've worked on where that has been the goal. Specifically, sort of the outset of my career, I did a lot of work promoting tram projects for Manchester City Council and included a guided busway, and social inclusion was at the heart of a number of those schemes. And I think it's really, developers will often work in partnerships with local authorities, but developers are often motivated by slightly different goals, but they can align with local authorities to deliver social inclusion. But it's generally driven by local authorities, in my experience.
Angus, I wonder if we could ask you to sort of chime in here. And I suppose if you were to take us on a tour of Glasgow, as it were, what would you point to show us how the council and the real estate industry have prioritised social inclusion in any projects that you think best exemplify that?
Well, I think from my experience, the best developments that we have that exemplify place building, communities being at the centre of developments, and the interests of people and social inclusion agenda being prioritised, they typically come from the social rented sector, the RSL sector, where the council generally would have more of an ability to work with RSLs, perhaps in collaboration with a private sector developer. There's more opportunity and leverage there to get these issues at the heart of the agenda. Where we maybe don't see that so much is where you have purely private sector-led development in the city. And I think that's something that cities like Glasgow have been struggling with for quite some time. It's the question of how do you develop a collaborative relationship with private sector investors and developers in order to get developments that have place at their heart, that have inclusion at their heart, and what are the tools that we use? Are they are they carrots or are they sticks? And what is the conversation that needs to be had there? So I think there are some great examples that we can look at across Glasgow, some award-winning local developments from the Andrewston area of Glasgow, which I happen to represent, Lauriston, some areas which have had historic kind of deprivation and all the rest, where you have fantastic quality housing developments having transformed those communities. But as I say, those tend to be RSL-led and social sector-led. It would be great to have more of that kind of quality of design and of with that inclusion focus to be able to pursue that more with the private sector as well, because we really need to ramp up this agenda right across cities.
Does it feel like those conversations are happening now more frequently?
I think they are certainly more than they used to be happening. And you know, planning officer, I'm not a planning officer. I'm obviously a politician. So our role is more in kind of talking about and articulating the vision for the city. But I think if you would speak to our planning authority, they would say that they are having those conversations more. And I think partly it's because cities like Glasgow are making a much clearer kind of statement about the kind of cities and the kind of communities that they want to see. So we are seeing developers come forward, you know, that are looking to align with those interests. But I still think there is some way to go in terms of figuring out exactly what those conversations need to be had at an early level to make sure that we have these issues, you know, explicitly embedded within the planning process and the journey from, you know, kind of a vacant site or a blank site through to a finished development.
A lot of developers talk about bringing more varied voices into discussions around new developments, and perhaps that begins at a sort of consultation phase when businesses are talking with the communities that will be most impacted by their schemes. Emma, what are the risks of not hearing, not listening to the communities that the industry serves, and how can companies like British Land ensure that they are being heard when projects are being thought up, mapped out, and then developed?
Well, the listening phase, Tim, is absolutely vital. I also think it helps when your motivations are quite long term. I mean, a bit like Angus mentioned, the RSL sector, British Land's a real estate investment trust, and what that means is that we're motivated to create long-term stable income streams out of successful places, and those start by creating great buildings, but also developing in and amongst communities that welcome development, support development, and see the benefits of it. And there is no excuse or no substitute for taking your time to listen. And at Canada Water, which is a town centre development that I'm bringing forward, we've spent 4 years listening to the local community there, who know the area infinitely better than we could ever begin to start to, and hearing their hopes and their dreams, but their worries and their fears. Not that you can respond to all of them, but you've got to listen to them and, you know, hope that when you bring forward a scheme, that it goes in some way to respond to some of the challenges that the place finds itself in, but also, you know, really aspires, I suppose, to meet what local people want for their local area. Very, very few developments in the UK, I would say, ever start from a completely blank sheet of paper. They are knitting themselves into existing communities, existing places that have history and have stories, and those need to be told through the new development that's created in a way that celebrates them, holds on to those memories. And really importantly, I guess we all aspire to make sure that development does something positive for the people who are hopefully welcoming it, and that they see and feel the benefit of development that's happening all around them. But it is listening, and it needs time, and there's no substitute for that.
I mean, you talk there about spending 4 years listening to communities around Canada Water. Now, I'm not going to ask you to encapsulate 4 years in just a few moments, but what for you were some of the highlights during that process? Maybe messages that you heard from the communities that you wouldn't, sitting in an office with British Land colleagues, necessarily have known without talking, without asking questions, and without listening to the answers? And how have those shaped the scheme that we're now starting to see brought forward?
They did a lot, actually. They gave me and the entire kind of master plan team a wealth of knowledge about the local area that we could just never have done from a desktop study or indeed, you know, spending time locally. Practical things like, you know, what are the routes and spaces that people really love and want to hold on to? And, you know, equally, what are the areas that they feel are not working so well? It might be small things like a pedestrian route or a cycle route, which is, you know, not doing its best in terms of encouraging active movement in and around the local area. Practical things like, you know, where everyone likes to congregate, where there was, a special moment that the community enjoyed, or a particular event that that they want to, see celebrated. So all that listening and learning enabled us to present a master plan, get consultation and engagement underway, and feedback on that. We then changed quite a few things as a result of that listening phase. We moved things like a leisure centre, which wasn't in the most popular spot for the community that it was down to serve, first and foremost. So we moved it to try and ensure that people were supportive of where it was going to be located. And then, things like the open spaces and the parks, what's our park and what's our new bit of public realm going to do that complements the existing spaces that are all around it, rather than just seeking to replicate just another square or another kids' playground. What is it that the area really needs or is deficient in? And then we complement and add to that, rather than trying to provide something shiny and new that is, replicating something that the place already has. And you learn that by listening to all sorts of people, young and old, some that have been there, 5 minutes, some that have been there 30 years. And, they've all got, a point, and yeah. You hope that you'll be able to listen to most of them and in some way, respond to them where you can.
Yeah. Now, it seems obvious to say that an industry that wants to succeed in encouraging inclusivity needs to itself be inclusive. Amos, I was wondering if you could tell us a little about the work of the Black Professionals in Construction Network and the ways in which you and your colleagues are working to encourage the industry to, I suppose, better reflect the societies that it's creating for.
Yeah. Thank you. I think, from the way things have been so far, as a network, we've been really encouraged by the way, our members are really, feeding back to us in terms of what they're looking for the society and the reflection in general. We've also been working, with some of the top tier developers, construction companies, and the real estate stakeholders to try and get the knowledge, like Emma said, in terms of what's actually needed out there, what are the areas that people feel like could be better in terms of society being engaged. And I feel like, I mean, the social value element of development is something that's been coming in lately into our society and into the decision-making process, which is fantastic because, like you said, sometimes people are building developments within certain areas which people don't relate with and don't feel like it comes along the journey with them. And, as a way forward, I think society is literally turning a corner in terms of what you're giving in. The social value element of things is starting to become a big element of the decision-making process. It's a balance, obviously, because there is business cases to be made, and also balancing it out with this is what the outlook of what we want our developments to be. So us as a network, in terms of getting the feedback, we've been actually really successful in collaboratively working and finding a balance point in terms of what can be done and what other elements are at stake in terms of the financial aspects, the time constraints, et cetera, and also making sure that feeding into these communities reflects what's going around there, reflects perhaps the culture and what people in the local area are looking for. And as well was mentioned, it's a process of actually listening to people and feeding that back in. But for me personally, the important thing is that it's happening. People are actually realizing it's an important part of it. And there's a lot of buy-in that's beginning to come across in terms of how important it is, because realistically, when you're working on the ground, it's probably in the past, it would have probably not been the most important factor, decision-making factor, but now it's actually starting to become really important, the social value element. So I'll probably say in terms of our network and how we're doing, we are literally emphasizing that to say, you know, people are there, communities are, you know, are widespread, they're diverse, they represent a lot of, and it's all adding to who we are, really, instead of just ignoring it. So I'll probably say, from our network perspective, that's the work we've been doing for literally being a bridge between communities and the real estate developers, the community building, in order to enable that change.
Excellent. Okay. Now, I was going to turn to some of the questions that we had submitted from people preparing to tune in for this discussion. We had a couple of questions, including from John Desmond and Gail Williams, about the impact of the, I suppose, enforced home working phenomenon that we've seen over the course of this year and the pandemic. If we think that home working trend is at least in some part here to stay now, what might that mean in terms of what we need our cities and towns to provide for communities? Christopher, I wonder if I could ask you for your thoughts on the impact of that trend as we look ahead.
Yeah, so anecdotally and from talking to clients and other people in the industry, it's really quite striking when you go into Canary Wharf, the city, and to a degree the West End, in terms of how empty they are compared with, you know, the suburbs, quite frankly. And I think people have realised the value of suburbs, even though they've been slightly unfashionable for some time, insofar as, you know, it's obviously a place you can live and work, and it's got your amenities on your doorstep. And I think the sort of greater mix of uses and a balance in terms of increasing workspace and public space is going to make a change going forward. These have become much more attractive spaces. And we've spoken to a number of developers who are sort of having a sort of campus sort of model as a theme of development going forward. And I think that is going to be the change. And I think cities, they've always, you know, they've really driven civilization and progress in human experience. They will have to reinvent themselves again, and I'm sure they will. It's just going to take some time to do so. But I think, you know, there's been some interesting articles in the press recently in terms of how the difference between Boston, which had a significant amount of tech industries at some point, but then the West Coast had a much more social network where people from different companies were able to express and share ideas. And I think that's going to be a big driver in terms of a draw back to cities, because of those tech industries thrived on people changing ideas. And that's how people do thrive in terms of this. And whilst we can do this very successfully to a degree, it doesn't make for much in terms of spontaneity or bumping into people or being introduced into someone else. So I think that's going to be a draw in due course. But, you know, at the moment, we're feeling our way through this. And I think from where we were now, where we were in March and where we are now, I think people are learning to live with it, even and though it's easy for me to say in a slightly where I'm not in the same level of restrictions in other parts of the country. But I think even then people are adapting.
Angus, what's the perspective from Glasgow as to how lockdown and working from home are sort of reshaping the outlook for the real estate industry and communities themselves?
I mean, I think it's our experience will be, you know, broadly comparable with other cities around the UK. I mean, I think the way I see it, it presents two kind of related challenges. So if we assume, as I think, you know, that it is fair to assume that, you know, there is a long running trend towards, you know, working from home, or at least more flexible working, and COVID has only accelerated that. It's not created some of the pressures, but it's made it more likely that we'll accelerate towards that, and possibly that the you know, there's certainly a clear risk that the kind of ongoing restrictions will be in some form in place for some time. You know, so you know, we might have to adapt to new ways of working a lot quicker than otherwise thought. But as I see it, I mean, number one, you've got this desire and this imperative to have more livable local neighbourhoods. I think, as the previous speakers just said, you know, people want to have amenities within their locality, within their local area. So we need to make sure that where we have development and where we're designing communities, that they are livable, that they are walkable. We start to talk about the 20-minute neighbourhood. In Scotland, it's an idea that the Scottish Government has just embraced. I know it's been talked about elsewhere. But really making sure that you have that very strong link whenever you're planning development between between housing and the amenities and the leisure facilities and all the rest, because you know we increasingly know that it's not going to be entirely feasible to expect that people are going to be travelling into the work every day in the city centre. You know, for you know, and therefore that's where we concentrate the amenities in the city, which brings me to the second challenge, as I see it, you know, which is city centre, city centres across the UK, and Glasgow's no different, have been experiencing real challenges as a result of the decline of retail, and I think if we have an even greater pressure on city centres from the lack of footfall around, you know, an increased instance of home working, then we need to really challenge our notions of what a city centre looks like, what it's for, what the different use types are there. So, you know, for example, in Glasgow, we as a city have historically actually had a very low residential population proportion in terms of a city centre. There's other cities that you know would typically have a far higher proportion of or level of residential population, and Glasgow's very much lagged behind that historically. So if the city centre is no longer going to be an exclusively central business district that people travel into for offices, and the you know the office market isn't you know going to be the be all and end all there, then we need to really accelerate our plans and our aspirations to increase residential accommodation there. And I think to link that point back to you know and sorry, I should say, and that needs to follow that same kind of livable, walkable ethos that I was outlining earlier. You know, but to link back to you know the points that we were making earlier. You know, we do need to make sure that it is planned, that master plans are put in place, and that we're thinking about how communities and I think that's especially important in the age of COVID.
Now, Angus, given that you are the council's digital champion, I was going to put this next question first to you. It was from Joanna Davies at Mills and Reeve, who asks, what is the role of prop tech in delivering social cohesion? How are you seeing technology reshape real estate and offerings?
Well, I mean, so if I take a, I'm far from a prop tech expert, but if I take a kind of expansive view of or understanding of property technology, I mean, I think one of the key ways that I think we are interested in exploring and promoting the use of technology in housing is the ways in which it can enable older people in particular to live independent lives. I mean, I know that's something that the NHS locally and the council are, you know, have been looking at and working on. And you know, if we have this, you know, if we're looking to meet the kind of challenges of an older population, we don't want to have this, you know, the situation where we're segregating people into to care homes or to care settings. We want to keep people as independent as possible in older life. Then, you know, clearly there are opportunities there with, you know, various technologies that you know, are allowing you know, people not only to older people not only to keep in touch more with them with their families and their loved ones and the support networks, but also with services that provides, you know, kind of urgent support. So I see, you know, the biggest kind of opportunity that I see in terms of digital technology in housing in particular is in allowing you know, that kind of older cohort who are increasingly being targeted, you know, as I see it, by the real estate market as a kind of distinct demographic. It's allowing them to live more independent lives for longer, and therefore to be more embedded in communities and retain you know, the social links that they otherwise have. Obviously, COVID is a slight caveat to all of that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's something that we're only at the very beginning of, you know, with much of technology and kind of smart solutions, we're only very much at the very beginning of understanding the possibilities that exist there. But I would be interested, and I don't necessarily have the answers, but I would be interested in knowing what we could do from a planning perspective to reflect some of these advances in technology and some of these opportunities. And it's not something that even, you know, despite, you know, Glasgow, for example, we have a digital strategy that talks about the opportunities here and links the council with the likes of the NHS, the Health Board, and other partners who are looking at these kind of options and these opportunities. That's not necessarily embedded so much within our planning policies and our planning guidance, our city development plan. So I would be interested, you know, from a strategic point of view, to understand what more we can do to link these two kind of strategic imperatives and these agendas together, and how then that translates into supporting the property sector to deliver on these opportunities and link everything up.
I think it's a great question. Amos, what is your take on how technology can be harnessed to help drive societal benefits within the built environment?
Yeah, so I feel like what's happened now was already coming. It's just been, you know, accelerated by the current situation. So if you look at, for example, in the past, you know, the city had, you know, malaria outbreaks, and that accelerated, you know, the way we were dealing with the sanitation, et cetera, et cetera. There was the London fires in the past, which obviously led to a lot of legislation in terms of insulation and fire protection, you know, sprinkler systems, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel like what's happening right now was going to happen anyway, and it's just been accelerated by the pandemic. We already had the technology, we already had all the systems in place which we utilize. What's going right now is just upgrading that, you know, and technology then is coming in the center of at the center of these conversations, in terms of, you know, the connectivity is now actually becoming part of the real estate industry and what people need to do, the people's working habits and cultures, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel like just grabbing that, I mean, this is an opportunity to do it because, I mean, number one, is meant to happen anyway. And secondly, it's happening now. So now it's actually, you know, within the real estate, actually looking at how important is technology and how can it be effectively integrated. So there is different ways of looking at it. You know, you have things like WiredScore, which is out there now, which looks at, you know, a building's connectivity and how it adds to the value of the building within the real estate, but also giving a balance of, like, you know, the affordability of the connectivity in terms of the fiber with the different communities. So, you know, looking at social housing and affordability of housing and how that all can be brought, you know, be brought together in a clever way to measure it. So I feel like if anything, this is the time to actually look and harness that technology, which is essentially going to be part of the real estate industry.
I like that idea of grabbing the opportunity, and I'm going to try to squeeze in one very quick last question here, which I'd like to get just a brief thought, I guess, from each of you on. The pandemic has obviously changed everything for the industry this year, but if you were to point to something that you think the real estate industry should keep front of mind if it's going to use this period as an opportunity to rethink what it offers communities, then what would you like to, what opportunity would you like to see it grasp? And Emma, could I ask you to kick us off here?
Sure. So I think if this has taught us anything at all, it is, and hopefully it has, it is that the importance of social connections are just far, you know, above and beyond anything that the built environment had ever really thought about. And I'm going to pick on a particular demographic, which Angus mentioned, which was the older demographic, because, you know, all of the projections are that we have an aging population. And I think we as an industry have woefully underserved that demographic for a long time. And what I'd like to see is, through digital innovation, us trying to engage that community, provide for them in terms of accommodation, but also provide for them in terms of how they access and move across our cities. You know, we at Canada Water are going to develop a mobility centre, which is going to help older people work out how they access products, how they access travel solutions, how they make sensible choices about how they move across their city. So that, you know, pandemics or otherwise, you know, we have real estate that's being designed and delivered and managed and operated in a way that welcomes all ages and all abilities. And, you know, I'd like to see us really hone in on that particular sector.
Hear, hear. Angus, some last thoughts from you.
I think the one of the biggest takeaways in terms of urban design and, you know, kind of designing cities is the importance of green space. 100%. You know, representing as I do the city centre of Glasgow, you know, we have some fantastic green space, but people generally, you know, in the city centre and surrounding areas don't have access to the kind of garden, you know, kind of private garden space that otherwise, you know, people in more suburban areas might be able to benefit from. So for me, the one, you know, the number one thing is that when we're looking to design communities and design housing, we need to make sure that there is that easy access to quality green space where people can, you know, people can relax, they can spend, you know, leisure time, you know, because we've had a real social issue, I think, of a lot of people in cities, especially more deprived parts of cities, who don't have that access to space, and they're essentially being cooped up in their house the whole time. So I think it is something, I mean, you can point to any number of, you know, good developments with good green space, but really putting that at the heart of future developments, I think, is an important takeaway.
Yeah. Amos, what would you like to see real estate keep front of mind as we move, I guess, through and beyond the crisis of the moment?
Yeah, for me, you know, from what I've seen, I think this is a real opportunity for the real estate industry. I mean, to sort of make a lot of noise about how much of an impact they've got on people's lives, you know, directly. You know, people were essentially locked in their houses, right, throughout the whole pandemic, and that's, you know, people began to see how big or small their spaces were, how effective their spaces were in terms of the work life. I know people that were, you know, in some cases you might not realize you're living in a really tiny space altogether, but it made it so obvious within the pandemic because you'd have been locked up together, whereas maybe in other times somebody began to work and you know, be back and forth. But I'll probably say, if the real estate industry is to grab anything, is how much of a direct impact it has on people's communities and lives, right? There is spaces where, you know, the built environment, the real estate is the second highest, you know, employer within communities. And number two, everybody lives in a community space, and people go to work, which is a work environment. And for me, it's looking at all the elements that can, you know, how can this impact on the housing element, on designing the spaces for, you know, domestically, and also the workspaces that people go to, right? As in, what are the spaces used for? You know, how can they be modified to the modern way of living? And we spoke about technology earlier on. How can technology be integrated into that? So if you're looking at what the real estate can grab as an opportunity, for me, is to highlight the importance of our industry effectively to all the stakeholders across the industry, to say we have so much impact on people's lives, right? And you know we're coming into this conversation from from a diversity perspective, right? People are beginning to see the, you know, connecting the two, to say, right, you know, people's social circumstances or communities are literally being affected by how it's built, how it's designed. So from number one, the planning side of it, how is it planned? Who is it planned for? And then the middle of, you know, the design element. And then when you look at the other end of the spectrum in terms of the construction, the delivery of it, et cetera, et cetera. So the number one thing I'll say is to grasp the opportunity is how important the industry is to people's lives directly.
Well said. And Christopher, you got the first word here. I'm going to offer you the last word as well. Something that you'd like, the real estate industry and the built environment to capitalize on as it rethinks what comes next.
Well, I think the main thing that we need to struggle on is integrating healthcare and making sure that people have well-being and good access to healthy spaces needs to be brought to the fore again. And in addition to that, and I do think it is connected, there are the challenges that the industry has got to face vis-a-vis biodiversity gain and going towards zero carbon. And I think where we can use data, and there's some great examples of the data that Emma's spoken about in terms of engaging with elderly people who can access cities, telling them the best way to get around across the world on that. It's using data to facilitate with those objectives in mind. And I think if you then link everyone's desires to come and work together and create a spontaneous interaction which rewards everybody, I think that's the key. I think, you know, the days of sort of slight monoculture zones are limited. I think you really got to go back to a sort of a broader mixed sense use with mixed uses which are attractive to everybody.
Excellent. Well, I hope that's an optimistic note to draw the conversation to a close on. Emma, Angus, Amos, Christopher, thank you all so much for making time to be with EG today and for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks for tuning in to this property podcast from EG. You can subscribe to our podcasts for more conversations like this and more from our Future of UK Cities event. You can also watch the videos of these panels by heading to egi.co.uk/the future of UK cities. And of course, you can subscribe to Radius Data Exchange for all of our real estate news, analysis, and data. Bye for now.